Hello and welcome to the seventh episode of the all-new GAK Guitar Shop podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, who is joining me today.
Hello, it's Luke. I'm one of the buyers.
Hello, it's Joss, and I run the YouTube.
Excellent. Hello, gentlemen, and how are we both doing?
Good.
Fantastic.
Unbelievably hot.
Yes, it is ridiculously hot on the day that we're recording this. It is 30 degrees in Brighton, which is pretty ridiculous, and we're recording this in a tiny little black room.
It's lovely though, because
it's actually slightly cooler.
I mean,
at the
this
moment.
Building is like an old stone building, isn't it? So it's got it contains
really hot.
The cool in this area of the building anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Unlike the rest of the building,
yeah,
that
which
just
is just
stores warmth.
Unhealthily hot.
Yes, exactly. Well, with this boiling hot week, I guess we had Glastonbury Festival last weekend.
As well. Did you enjoy yourself?
You went to Glastonbury, didn't you?
I did. It was incredible. I've never been before. Best weekend of my life.
Oh, really? First time you've gone?
Yeah. I'm still broken.
Did you go on your own or did you go with other people?
No, there are about 20 of us.
Oh, bloody hell. That's the way you want to do it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of the days by myself because my music taste is quite different to a lot
of
my friends.
Of course.
So I'd spend the days by myself, and then we'd sort of meet up at like 11 after we've done all the bands, and then do the going out for nights thing.
Cool.
It was great. Absolutely incredible.
Did you watch Kanye West?
I saw part of it, but that was only because I picked a girl up after she ran into a bin and nearly knocked herself out. And
How big was the bin?
It was an oil can.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
She was very drunk. She totally lost her friends. She had no idea what was going on. So I sort of picked her up, sat her down, and then was like, where are your friends? And they're like, right at the front.
Oh, Jesus.
So we had to get down to the front to find her friends. She found them, and she's okay.
That's incredible that you managed to find her friends amongst thousands of people.
Well, she just tore off. Like, she sort of remembered where they were.
Oh, fair enough.
So kind of she tore off, and I just followed to make sure she didn't run into another bin.
Yeah, of course. Many an oil.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was quite funny.
So any highlights for you from Glastonbury?
Seeing the rapturous applause from the audience, maybe three tunes from the end of the second Everything set.
Right.
And the singing.
They did two sets.
Yeah, a lot of the bands I really wanted to see did two gigs. One on a bigger stage and then one in like a little stage called Williams Green.
Oh, right.
Williams Green is set up like a little club gig. And then so obviously all the bigger bands play bigger places because no one could ever get into Williams Green.
You
had to get there early.
Right.
So yeah, watched them on the other stage, which is sort of the second biggest stage. Went to see them at Williams Green, and as a third song from the end, everyone just went absolutely crazy. Like, it was the most epic finish to not the end of a set I've ever seen. Everyone in the audience went absolutely mental, and the singer was so sort of taken by it, he nearly started crying.
Amazing.
And he just sort of stood there and went, there is no emoticon to express this emotion.
I was disappointed to see that they've taken to dressing like plonkers again.
Yeah, that looked a bit weird, I thought.
Yeah, well, they used to, didn't they? They used to wear boiler suits and looked awful. It was only on the second album, which was, in my opinion, their only good one.
You are totally wrong. I know, you are broken.
I know. But they started dressing normally for that one. I went to see them play. I always thought of them more as a club band than an open air band. I have to say the Glastonbury highlights weren't doing them any favours.
They sounded
in the
awful on the TV. From the front of the stage, they sounded out of this world.
It's so often the case, isn't it? I think the TV really you don't get the full feel of the actual instrumentation, and what you do get is whether or not the vocalist is
perfectly
out of key, which is very rarely the case on gigs of that
especially
scale.
With everything
so his vocals were a little bit
shrill,
lackluster.
But they are on record, that is his voice. I mean, Mick Jagger can't bloody sing. I mean, it's never really hurt him.
No, exactly.
But one thing I was totally awed by was how good every one of the stages sounded.
Really?
Yeah.
That makes a nice change. I've been twice, and I wouldn't go again for the reason that I thought it was the worst sound across the board.
Really?
Well, I went 2005 and 2007, and to be fair, 2005 was the year that it rained so bad that they couldn't do 2006.
but they couldn't do the year before.
No.
They had to go back in time. Yeah. Sorry, we're going to have to cancel this because you've set it up badly.
Exactly. But No, yeah, they. I mean, there were tents being washed downhill in 2005. It was absolutely ridiculous. But for example, during the Killers set on the Pyramid stage at the end, the entire left side or stage right of the sound system went down. I unfortunately had chosen that side along with, you know, whatever. I don't know
however many hundred thousand people.
Yeah. Had so all of these people are trying to cram over to the only side where you can hear anything, because you were hearing echoed
sound
from the other side, and it was just terrible. And sort of for the main headliner on one of the nights, I think it happened twice in a row. Admittedly, Glastonbury were obviously dealing with
a flood,
torrential downpour, but nonetheless, I was left disappointed by the festival at my times there.
Genuinely, this time around, great.
Really,
every stage sounded just bang on. I guess it's much easier in dry conditions to engineer for lots of space, and tents don't sort of compact the sound like walls do.
Yeah, so I guess. So gear-wise, whilst you were there, did you spot anything good? Because I have to say, from watching the highlights, there was quite a bit of really cool gear that I saw.
Well, jog my memory, because I was there and it's a bit of a blur. if I'm being totally honest.
Well, just if there was anything that stuck out to you.
I didn't know what the amps Death Cab for Cutie were using were, and that really intrigued me.
Oh, were they good?
Yes, but they're also custom. I could sort of see a little part on them that said Acme.
I mean, those guys.
Oh, Death Cab were absolutely on it.
I mean, their newest album is phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the music there. I maybe know a few tunes.
Oh, okay.
I sort of went just because there wasn't anything else going on that afternoon. And went, and they were absolutely flawless.
Yeah, they're so good. They're
like,
so good.
Like, the performance was perfect, but not in that over-polished sense.
No, I mean, I think that's the sort of thing that you gather from a band that have been doing it for so long.
Yeah.
They're just professionals at what they do.
Yeah,
that's their trade.
So slick.
Yeah.
But yeah, it turns out they were something called Acme Silvertone, which one of their techs made.
Oh, wow.
I thought they sounded incredible. And they're based around the 1484 model, which is what Jack White used.
I see.
Like, he uses the originals with they had like little tiny transformers, of which I have one of the originals sitting at home waiting for me to build into an amp. I've made the power supply, I've made the preamp, haven't made the power amp.
Amazing.
Haven't done anything on it in about 2 years. Sometime I'll finish that. But yeah, they sounded incredible, those amps.
Oh, brilliant.
I think he'd sort of suit them up and put some bigger transformers in, and they sounded a bit more powerful than the originals, because the originals sound like really trashy.
Hence
the White Stripe sound.
Yeah, of course.
Beyond that, I didn't see anything else that I would have noted as being particularly cool.
I just thought, kind of across the board, I didn't see a lot of one brand sponsorship that I think you get at a lot of festivals. You tend to see it will inevitably be someone like Orange or Marshall who will really get on board. Now, I of course appreciate with the bigger bands they don't have to, but nonetheless, at a lot of festivals you'll see change up for that sort of thing.
I was a bit surprised to see everyone changing over their own gear.
Yeah.
Like, even smaller bands.
Really?
Like, everyone just had their own stuff. And I guess that comes a little bit from sort of Glastonbury not having that corporate sponsorship.
Yeah.
Not that amp sponsorship is corporate.
No, but still,
where kind of Glastonbury works the other way around, where they give the money out as opposed to try and take it in.
Yeah.
I think it works a bit differently. Mm.
Maybe as well as the different sounds that all of those bands like Glastonbury will play. Like, one band will play and then the next band will sound completely different.
Yeah.
Whereas you go to Download and then one stage, like the Monster stage, might be endorsed by just Orange.
Yeah,
and
all the
bands will use that gear and be okay with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certainly, if anything, it's kind of how Ashdown made a name for themselves. Sponsoring stages. And so all the bass players were playing Ashdown gear. And That was the case for quite a few years, sort of throughout the 2000s.
Yeah. Did see quite a lot of Ashdown there.
Did you?
Yeah.
I saw a surprising amount of Fender Super Bassmans. And yes, I would normally expect to see Orange bass amps, Ashdown bass amps, and of course Ampeg there.
Kind of
prolifically. But I saw a lot of Fender Super Bassmans. I really think that the Fender Super Bassman is replacing the Ampeg SVT Classic as the big valve head.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Because the 8200, the Orange 8200 is the most popular, I guess.
Yeah, I saw more 8200s there than I would have said I saw super basemans.
Oh, really?
But now you mention it, I did see a few big super basemans.
Yeah, they were.
I'm coming back
about
to you in flashes, small flashes.
I saw very some much really so interesting gear from the Maccabees, actually.
I missed their set, really annoyingly.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
Not a bit washy for me, that band, but I'm always annoyed by bands with three guitarists, especially when the Maccabees have three guitarists, yet their bass player does most of the lead work. And I just can't work out why they've got three guitarists.
And yeah, they seem to just make really sort of about turns in songs that don't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
They sort of spend all this time setting something up and then suddenly dump in another section and then go back to the original, and it's almost sort of linear, and I just don't think they do that very well.
No. Yeah, they've always been a bit, yeah, and just, yeah, just a bit washy. But
yeah,
gear wise I have to say, some of the best equipment I saw at the festival.
What did they have?
Well, one of their guitarists who was playing what's the smaller body of the Gibson hollow body,
339,
is that I thought 330 was the smallest.
Well, no, the 330 is the same sort of size as 335, isn't
yeah
it?
Yeah.
Is it? Oh, right.
Yeah, the 339 is the newer, smaller. It's like the Les Paul size.
Right, okay. Yeah, so he was more or less switching between a Sunburst and a Black 339. But his amps, he had two old Selmer amps.
Right.
Different Selmers. One of them was one of the black-faced Selmers from sort of the early 80s.
Yeah, with like the checker cross.
Yeah, that's like, right. You'd easily confuse it for Wem.
Yeah,
at a distance sort of thing, and the other one was the sort of the Selmer,
the silver faced ones,
yeah, that's
with like
right
vertically arranged knobs,
yeah,
like
yeah,
the old treble and basses,
yeah, exactly,
yeah,
both combos, and both those are sort of long and thin and tall, so
right,
212s probably, but the other yeah way around from the way we expect a guitar amp to be sort of set up today,
yeah.
Which I just thought was wicked, and then
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and then a load of like Vox hand wired stuff, and
oh yeah,
it was just cool. Yeah. It was just cool gear, and then like really smashed up Ampeg SVT 300
cool
and 2 810s on
it's
the sides.
It's been toured, you know.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Been
played. Which is, yeah, their gear all looks like that.
Yeah.
It was a lot less shiny than some of the others.
It's the same as when I saw the Gaslight Anthem at the Brighton Dome. All of their stuff was just smashed up, but it was all hand-wired Vox, white Voxes that you could see were just all torn and black and really cool, and loads
yeah
of other really good bits and pieces. I just love it when you see the bands that are like using their gear properly, you know, just using it.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Anyway, sort of wildly off topic, I guess. So it's sort of talking about gear there, but so I guess you were at Glastonbury, so you probably really haven't checked out anything new in the last week or so.
Sadly, no.
What about you, Joss? How's your week been?
Yeah, it's been all right. What did I check out recently? I've done a video for the IRT Pulse, like a
oh, yeah
more in-depth one.
Yeah, that's right, because we've got a competition coming up for the Laney
we
IRT
do, yeah
Pulse.
Yeah.
Tell people about the IRT Pulse, just in case they're not sure what
cool
we're talking about.
Well, the IRT
yeah
Pulse,
I don't know what this is.
Well, the IRT Pulse is a USB connectivity, like a valve-driven preamp system.
Right.
So it can be used as a foot pedal, because you can buy a foot switch attachment to like an unlatching foot pedal or a latching foot switch.
Okay.
So you can use it as an overdrive pedal. Or
it's
you can,
quite a weird sort of shape and height.
It is. It's quite
well, like you can
it
use
is
it
quite
as a
big.
Yeah.
But or you can turn up to a gig because it's valve driven. You can turn up to a show and it's got a balanced out, so you can go direct into a PA, and it's got an emulated speaker cabinet button on it as well.
Cool.
Which makes it sound, obviously if you use it on a cab it doesn't really sound that
yeah,
nice with the emulation on
two cabs.
Yeah, exactly. But I've done it on the demo just to show what it sounded like. I went through every section. Being like a massive jazz fusion fan of like the Holdsworth tone and stuff like that, it does that really well. It's got
cool
like this dark switch on it, so
yeah
you put the gain whatever you want, hit the hot switch to engage the overdrive, hit this dark switch, and it has this really fluid, beautiful sort of watery overdrive on it.
Nice.
It's just a really, really diverse piece of gear, because you can go direct, it acts as an interface, so you can go
yeah
direct
yeah, yeah
into your recording equipment and record straight onto your DAW.
Cool.
Which just kind of, and it's got live real-time reamping like this.
I
like,
was about to say, does it
like
do
the studio
reamping?
Yeah,
like
yes.
So it's a really, really diverse small piece of gear, and it comes in a velvet like glove, which is called like a carry bag,
like auger pedals.
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's just another great example of Laney making something really intuitive,
yeah,
and really versatile. I think they've done really, really well recently, going from being sort of 10 years ago a kind of a budget metal brand,
and totally just
who looked awful.
Missing the
yeah.
point.
Mm, yeah, missing the point. Their definitely. Gear looked terrible as well. Yeah. So all of a sudden, you know, we get the British built Lionheart stuff, which looks amazing.
Got the 525 as well, the new ones, yeah. which are like much smaller, and they just sound incredible. I mean, yeah. they're so good that you got people like Tom Quayle, who is like one of the most foremost jazz fusion players out there at the moment in YouTube world. Definitely, if you're listening, check Tom Quayle out. He's a monster player. He's endorsed by Laney Amplification now, and he was using things like. You remember the company Port City?
No.
Like just clean boutique built amplification, but he's cool. using Laney now.
Yeah.
Which is crazy to go from something that costs a horrendous amount of money, yeah. custom build things, to go into Laney, which is a really, really reasonable price for a British hand built amplifier.
Yeah. But then yeah. I mean Laney did the same thing back in the sort of early mid 90s when they got sort of Satriani
yeah.
and Vi and everyone on board, and Gilbert.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone on board using the old GH100s and the VH100s. And
then they sort of just, as well, at that point.
Yeah, yeah. They yeah. just got a bit lost, I they think. Did. And yeah. now they've sort of sorted it out and come back again.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, just one of few brands that are kind of making amps across the board that people can use in loads of different genres yeah. and making them very individualized. I mean, I really thought it when on the podcast, on the old podcast, when we did Gear of the Year, when the studio came out, which wasn't this year, but the year before, I really fought for that. It got into our top 30, and I think it made it into our top 10 yeah. Of Gear of the Year. And I think it was my pick for top 3, but I don't think it made it that far. But of just an incredibly intuitive amp that kind of came out of nowhere and with a price tag that was sort of out of nowhere for what you were getting on the studio as yeah. well. I thought $399.
I mean, I can vouch for it because I gigged with it for about a year
yeah.
without a cabinet, just going direct. Yeah. And it sounded nice. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, and another thing, guys. In that video, I play an Ibanez RC720 and I bought one. So
have you got it yet?
No, it comes next week because the guys at Ibanez are doing stock checks.
Oh, right.
Like, you know, so I have to wait a week until mine turns up, but it's paid for and I can't bloody wait to get it.
Yeah.
So check out the demo on the IRT Pulse that I've done, because not only do I play the Pulse and do a good demo on that, but I'm playing my new guitar. So
yeah, it's really cool. A really interesting guitar for Ibanez.
Oh, man, the Roadcore series is just the best.
Well, just I just thought an unusual thing for Ibanez to do, considering the type of instruments that they make and who they make guitars yeah. for, which is predominantly a metal market, to introduce like a, I guess, a Jaguar style
yeah, like
shape.
An offset style guitar.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not a predictable shape.
No.
For
the premium model that I've gone for with the wood-mounted pickups and everything, and the rosewood top double binding and stuff like that. I mean, the good thing about it is because it's so basic and everything, just because of the shape kind of lends itself to an overall sort of plethora of different styles you want to play it with. But the good thing about it is that you can play super, super heavy stuff on it, as well as super clean it up and play some cool jazz stuff on it. That's what I love about it, that I don't think you can really feel comfortable doing on an RG because the neck's
yeah.
so slim
yeah.
and you're like, right, I'm going to shred now. Whereas on the Roadcore, I can sit down and go, right, I'm going to absolutely tear it up now, or I just want to flick it onto clean and play some nice R&B stuff. You know?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's definitely
get your R&B chops.
Get my R&B chops done.
But it's also a completely slab instrument. There are no contours on it.
Nothing.
Is that right?
It's just a complete double bound strong piece of wood,
which for me seems like it seems like the opposite of everything Ibanez stands
yeah,
for. They're the ultimate contoured company.
Yeah, but then I guess they sort of come out of doing all sort of the Les Paul lawsuit guitars and things
yeah.
way back in the day. So
Rickenbacker lawsuit guitars as well.
Yeah, all that.
They did everything.
Yeah.
They ripped it all off.
You know, I'm always going to stand by that Ibanez raising their game is because of me. I remember when the chaps from Ibanez came into the store, I introduced myself in Japanese because I've been, you know, I know how to speak a little bit of Japanese. And then after that, I said to them, you've got to change your ways. And they changed their ways.
They
started bringing out hard-tailed guitars. They started bringing out guitars with aftermarket pickups after I said, you've got to put aftermarket pickups in your guitars, guys.
So there we have
clearly,
it.
There it is. Joss, the unofficial head of Ibanez.
Design.
Cheers. Thank you.
Head of product innovation.
Yeah.
I think you're cool.
Arigato.
So let's move on to the topic for this week, for this week's podcast. I was kind of thinking about the fact that Glastonbury Festival was just behind us, and there were lots of, you know, big rock legends and others, you know, swinging their guitars around and stuff. And I thought that we could talk about the gear that was there, but evidently Luke was too drunk to remember any of the gear was there, and me and Justin go.
I can remember it all. I just need a little bit of memory jogging.
I mean, it is, you definitely, you've only been back a couple of days and you're definitely not back.
Yeah. I think I got a couple of emails through just of just nonsense, just gobbledygook, like, Joss, guitars? Question mark.
It's 5 days. It's a long time,
I agree.
5 days, was it?
Yeah.
Unreal. I couldn't do that. I could
five
camp
days
for
in
like
a tent.
2 days max.
It's 5 days of camping with no showers and getting up at 8 and getting to bed at 6.
Went to Reading Festival to see Pearl Jam, and I stayed there for 1 day and I couldn't use the toilets.
It's Reading Festival's got nothing on there. I've done Reading numerous times.
No, yeah, Reading's okay. Actually, no, Reading does have long drops now. It depends when Joss went, but Reading is now long drops, which is the same as Glastonbury.
I was quite impressed by the toilets.
You were impressed by long drops. I don't know why they don't use Portaloos.
No, they're compost toilets now.
Oh, are they? They've changed them again.
Big and nice and breezy.
Oh, that's good.
It's like open air.
If you've ever used a long drop, it's absolutely horrific going up there.
I think we're in danger of getting into grounds that people don't want to hear.
Yeah,
about.
that's probably true. I'll leave the long drop story.
Just let it, like sort of stew in your mind.
Yeah, okay.
Long drop.
It's horrendous. Anyway,
going from sort of days like watching Courtney Barnett at 11 in the morning, right the way through to the same day watching Hiatus Coyote at 2 in the morning.
Oh my god, Hiatus Coyote played.
Twice.
Oh my god, didn't you saw them?
Twice.
Oh my god.
Once at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was so tired, it was just the best experience of my life.
I'm
knackered to possibly count, trying to keep track of all the modulations and time changes.
Did you just get dizzy? And
yeah. It nearly made me pass out.
Yeah, and what about the next time? Did you see him in a more
so
configured
good.
State?
Yes, I was totally together, and it was even better.
Dude, I have been following that band for a long time, and I've got all their LPs and CDs, and I just cannot believe I haven't even seen them. They're playing the Islington, and I didn't even find out until today.
Yeah, they are absolutely incredible.
I wish I could have seen that. I love that band.
Yeah, well, yes, let's move on to the topic, which I thought we could talk about, kind of, I guess, on that vein. We're going to talk about the gear of our heroes. Now, it doesn't have to be us, you know, in any particular order. I appreciate everyone's got, you know, lots of guitarists that they revere. So I thought we could just kind of pick three and maybe go around the room, a bit like we did last week with the guitars that were twang for their buck. But this time with kind of people who I guess have influenced us, and we can talk about their equipment and what it is that makes their sound. Luke Taft, if I start with you, I'll run around the room.
I think since we're probably going to start with the obvious ones, I'm going to go to Nuno.
Sweet.
As everyone was probably expecting.
Yes.
Definitely at some point.
Nuno, back in the day, Marshall JCM 800s with a modified Strat body that he shaved the body down on.
Right.
Bill Lawrence humbucker in the bridge. Later he got the N4, Swamp Ash body, Stevens extended cutaway, like we were talking about on the other Washburns.
Yeah.
Obviously Floyd Rose, sort of modified shape to a Strat, so it's a bit sort of thinner across the sort of the longest axis.
Yeah.
And it's a bit more sort of comfortable. When he first wanted to put it together, he had a bit of an argument apparently with Washburn, because everyone wanted to do crazy colours, and he was like, no, I want my guitar to be wood coloured. And they were like, no one's going to buy a wood-coloured guitar.
Me to make a guitar then. Do you know what I mean? It's my choice.
And eventually he was like, no, you've got to make this in wood. I want it wood. You're oiling the body. You're not putting any paint on it, because I want the body to resonate. So they made it. And then a couple of years later, all of a sudden, everyone was making oil-bodied wooden guitars.
Yeah.
And that's the way everything went. I don't know how much that was him and how much that was just the trends, but I think it was quite nice. And interestingly, apparently his original agreement with Washburn was that because his income was so sporadic, rather than them giving him an income based on how many guitars he sold, they just gave him enough money to send back to his mum in Portugal so she could keep hold of and pay the rent.
Amazing.
Like, that was the agreement.
That's That's amazing. That was an endorsement deal.
Yeah. But it was, you know, it was what he wanted, and it kept his mother in a house.
I was going to say, it shows what sort of person he is. It's pretty cool.
He's a lovely fella.
Why don't you tell people a bit about the N4? Because I think we mentioned it a few times, but I don't think we've ever really talked about the Washburn M4. So if there are any listeners that aren't aware of it, because it's not that popular anymore, it's a guitar that's sort of drifted away.
Well, I think it's because it's so synonymous with Nuno. It's such a wicked guitar, but you just can't play one without someone going, oh, that's the Nuno guitar. It's like the normal body, well, the normal setup is an alder body, a maple neck with an ebony board. It's got sort of a headstock designed by Nuno, which is like a reverse Strat headstock with a little bit cut out. We're going to have to edit.
I fell over. Carry on.
He was doing so well at sneaking
You're
out
doing
over
so
the room
well,
to get
man.
His water.
I can't believe you I was, shot I was, there the
I was,
last hurdle.
I was trying to get my water. Oh, I'm keeping this in.
You have to. That was awesome. I enjoyed
Fantastic.
That.
Fantastic.
Sorry,
Can
M4?
We make this a video cast from now on?
I know, right?
Yeah, that's
I think that needs
N4.
To be...
N4.
Yeah, maple neck, scarf jointed headstock, so it's not on straight like a normal Strat. Three-way pickup switch, which is down in the top horn, so it's not like the five-way blade. Coil tap on a volume control, which is put a bit further away from where it would be normally on a Strat. Original Floyd Rose, Bill Lawrence, I think it's an XL500L in the bridge, and a Seymour Duncan 59 in the neck.
I don't know much about Bill Lawrence.
He was a pickup builder that just sort of started making some really hot pickups. And they got picked up by a lot of people. I think Dimebag Darrell was one of the first people to really use them.
Yeah, he used one in the bridge as well.
Yeah, like when you look at them, they were like the first pickups that were like blades.
Oh, right, yeah, of course. So it's the bladed pickup in the N4.
Yeah.
And it's still a Bill Lawrence today.
Yeah. There's a lot of controversy around them, though, because sort of Stuart McDonald in the States started making what some have alleged to be knockoffs that weren't from Bill Lawrence.
Right.
And some people think Bill Lawrence makes terrible pickups because they've bought what are supposed to be these counterfeits.
I see.
But Bill Lawrence and his family still make pickups. And if you email them, I don't know about now, but I emailed them a few years ago. And it was like his daughter that replied.
That's
like
amazing.
Him, his wife and his daughter and some other people. And that's who they are. So yeah, that's basically the spec of it. Wicked guitar. They've done a lot of different variations over the years. Like they've done lots of different bodywork. They've done some in Carina, some which have been finished. The ESA is the Swamp Ash version, which is probably the most popular.
Yeah,
now.
I was going to say, yeah, because when you said alder, I was like, the N4 that I have in my mind has always been an ash body.
Yeah, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think that came slightly later because the original N1 and N2, which were the customs that Nuno made, I think were Swamp Ash, were alder.
Right.
I think.
I see.
So yeah, in terms of amps, as I say, sort of used to use a JCM 800 with a rat into it.
Really? A rat?
Yeah. If you listen to like the early recordings, it's that really gnarly sort of hot kind of tone. But I don't think he used to push the rat that hard. I think he used to use it more as a boost.
Right.
The Bill Lawrences are quite aggressive anyway, aren't they?
Yeah. There's a lot of gain coming out of those. And like, I mean, on the early records, it just sounds like a sort of a classic Marshall sort of thing. But then again, I think for the recordings, he used an amp that he borrowed and just used that.
I see.
Later moved over to Rat Gear and was using an ADA MP1.
Uh-huh.
And that's like the really aggressive buzzsaw tone on Porno Graffiti. That is just the brightest guitar tone you can imagine. That is all treble, nothing else.
Yeah.
And I love it. I think that's why I like such aggressive guitar tones.
Yeah.
Again, the N4 is stuck right the way through this, so he's never really deviated from that. Mid-90s, he sort of moved over to using the Mark I Hughes & Kettner Triamps.
Really?
Yeah.
The Triamps?
It was a big endorsee for
We've
the Triamps.
We've got a Triamp at the moment.
Yeah.
We've got a second-hand one, I think.
Yeah. They're good amps. I mean,
they look ridiculous.
Yeah.
They look ridiculous.
The Mark III's look even more ridiculous. Have you seen the picture showing all the different modes?
With the double knobs. It's unbelievable how much stuff is on the face of that.
There's a picture showing all the different modes and all the different power setups. and it's just like this crazy spider diagram. It looks a little bit like looking at the tube map.
Really? Oh, like, that's amazing. That's so Hughes and Kettner through and through.
It's just crazy. I mean, if you want an amp that does everything, that's it. I mean, I had a Mark One for a while and I couldn't quite get the tone I wanted out of it, which was annoying because I could get every other tone now out of all the six modes that were in it.
Yeah. Do you ever see that German guitar player Thomas Blug and the Hughes and Kettner demo guy?
Thomas Blug.
That done like the Strat King videos.
No, I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, he done all of their videos at one point for like the Statesman and the Triumph and stuff like that. And I remember having a Guitarist magazine CD, like DVD, and he was on there doing a demo of the Hughes and Kettner Triumph, and I must have watched that so many times.
Really?
Because I just remember loving that Strat tone. But it's really weird. You have to watch the video at some point.
I'll see if I can find it somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's his setup. I mean, pretty minimal on pedals. He uses like an old Boss OC1.
Right.
And then the Rat, and then I think maybe another
drive. An OC1?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like proper old school Japanese. Like, he's got just the best tone for big, chunky octave riffing.
Yeah.
There's like on the Waiting for the Punchline album, the last secret track, Waiting for the Punchline, just comes in and it is absolute monster.
Right. What delay does he use for his like live, crazy bumblebee thing?
That was originally back in the day off an ME5.
Oh, okay.
Like, he's always used a lot of Boss multi effects. And then when he was touring with Rihanna, he was using, I want to say, I think it was like a GT8 or maybe a GT100, but I don't know if the 100 was out by then. But that was just his rig, basically. He ran into that and then into an amp and then.
Yeah, I guess I was always such an unpretentious fellow that I'm not at all surprised that he was using a multi-effects delay.
To tour with Rihanna.
Do you see like, it's cool, the Idol, sparkly Idol guitars they got built for him?
Yeah, I was about to mention those, the P4s.
Yeah.
When he did the Schizophonic album.
Yeah.
Yeah, he sort of, for a while, wanted to be like a Les Paul player. So they kind of redesigned the shape of the Les Paul a bit and made it like a three-a-side headstock, like signature. And that was another guitar he did for a bit, but that didn't really stick.
Didn't really take off, did it?
No, the N4, that's the one.
That's the one.
But yeah, I think that's most of his gear. Most that I can remember off the top of my head.
So N4s are still available in the market.
Triumph and Mark III's are now.
Yeah, they're kind of... And do you think the Triumph's the thing to go for to get his tone?
No, I think it's probably JCM 800, 2203 with a Rat.
So, yeah.
What about his Randall?
Totally missed out the signature amps. He had it still has a range of Randall signature amps.
Oh, really?
With the most obnoxious volume knob on an amp you could ever imagine. About that big.
Really? Oh, yeah. Amazing. Yeah. It's just, this is radio, so people, when you say it's that big.
Oh, I was not saying it to you. I'm sorry.
It's quite
about
large.
The size of an orange.
Yeah, about the size of an orange volume knob, yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And they're sort of laid out to look like old scientific equipment instead of
an amp.
Which is pretty cool.
His on button should have been like a Frankenstein switch. That would have been cool.
So yeah, that apparently, from what I've heard on the design on that, it is basically specced up to be an old Marshall with a boost in the front of it. To run like a Rat into a Marshall.
Oh,
and then
brilliant.
That's what he uses now.
That's what most old school players do, though, isn't it? It's like the Slash, it's like the Kerry King. They're all the standard, almost 800, JCM 800 style amps, with a tube screamer in front, essentially, like a boost function.
Or the UNV, which is just the 2203 with a different boost in the front of it. He uses like a Dodd or whatever.
Yeah, something crazy, isn't it?
Amazing. But yeah. Okay, cool, sweet. Joss Allen.
Cool. My guitar players are like more modern heavy metal guitar players, so their gear isn't as extensive as that, but they've got some really cool bits and pieces. First guy I'm going to do is Andy Marsh from Thy Art Is Murder. Definitely my favourite band at the moment. They just released an album called Holy War. Make sure you check it out. His guitar, I believe, because he just had it refinished in a bright yellow, is an Ibanez RGD-2127Z in the see-through black finish, like the ghost finish, I think. It's like a satin black finish.
But he's just had it refinished
in
graffiti yellow.
Okay.
Very, very cool. I'll show you a picture.
He's a seven-string player.
He's a seven-string guitar player. Both of the guys in Thy Art Is Murder use custom Ibanez guitars. But I'm focusing on Andy just because he's the lead guitar player of the band, so he's probably most inspirational to me. So his guitar, as I said, is an RGD-2127Z, the Prestige model. If you haven't seen the RGD model, it's like an RG, but with sharper fins. And it's got like more body cutouts where the fins are.
Right.
So it's pretty stealth looking. And he's got some Seymour Duncans in there that the Seymour Duncan have sent him. He's got the Sentient and the Nazgul in it, cool. Which is pretty cool.
What, nice Sentient in the neck, Nazgul in the bridge?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, I believe so. I'm not too sure about what positions they go in, to be honest.
Do you know what the difference is between the Sentient and the Nazgul tonally?
I think the Nazgul is a lot more aggressive because in terms of it being like along the lines of a 7-string version of the Black Winter.
Right. Were you saying, Luke, that the Nazgul is the most wound pickup that they...
Yes, I think off the top of my head, the Nazgul is the hotter.
Okay, so that makes sense to it and being the 7-string version of like the Black Winter version.
Yeah. And then the Pegasus of that series is the lightest.
Right, I got it.
I think the Pegasus is the one that is neck only.
I see.
Mm. Off the top of my head.
Yeah, and then he's got a Sentient in the neck, I believe. So that's kind of cool in terms of the guitar. I saw him post it on Instagram recently and I went completely insane for it. And then his amp. I love the amp choice because it's my amp choice. He plays the EVH 5150-3, the 100-watt version.
Who had it first?
I definitely did.
Sweet.
Definitely.
Did you send him an email to let him know?
When he first bought it and he put a picture up of it, I was thinking about saying...
Like,
but well done. Bagsies. Sort of thing, but I didn't. I refrained. I did add him on Facebook, and within 10 minutes, he accepted. And I typed, "Thank you for the accept," thinking, like, he's not going to give a poo about me. And then he emailed back saying, "No worries, dude. Glad you like enjoy the album and stuff like that." Because I said, "Thank you for the accept. Love the album as a true fanboy."
Sweet.
And he emailed back saying, "No worries, man. Glad you enjoy the email." And I had like a fan moment day, just walking around going, yes.
Did you print it out?
Yes. No, I screenshot it. So, yeah. And, EVH 5150. And to be honest, when you're playing super heavy metal music like Diet is Murder, you don't need any pedals apart from a tuner because that EVH Red Channel will cover everything you need. I think he has a noise gate. Most probably has a noise gate in the front end just for literally because of it being, you know, needing the super tight sections to be tight.
Yeah.
And when he plays guitar solos, he has a delay, but I don't know what delay he uses because there's no... You know, when you're with these bands, there's never any sign of actually what extensive... their gear showing on terms of photos and video, they're never really extensive in terms of what they have. Yeah, do you know what I mean? You kind of gather what they're using by watching live shots or seeing photographs of them live. You never see him. I mean, the only video I've ever seen of him talking about his guitar is our one, the one that you did with him, Joe.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, that's the only it was, one online.
I did it with Total Guitar at Download Festival last time. So he just sort of spoke about his gear and that.
Sweet.
He had excellent shoes. That's all I really remember. I didn't know who they were.
I'm taking away from this that you're more noting of fashion. Everything don't like them because they started dressing a bit silly.
Yeah, but his shoes, like Andy Marsh's shoe Nike collection, is off his natch.
Okay. Has he got the proper Back to the Future shoes?
He wasn't wearing those.
No, he wasn't wearing those.
But, you know.
I mean, there's only a certain few people that have those.
Cool.
So basically the 5150, which is, do you know how much it is off the shelf at the moment?
My 50 watt one was about 995. It's around about that sort of mark.
Right. So, I mean, you know, as far as a 50 watt amp is concerned, the EVH are a really reasonable price point and really good for the money. And the 7-string, he plays a Prestige.
He plays model. A Prestige model, yeah. The Japanese model. Two of the models, both of them that he has are Prestige models. No sort of skin off the back of the more affordable models. It's just that I reckon that if you're going to tour worldwide, I think that the Prestige models are definitely a choice, you know?
Yeah,
or totally. The new premium models could definitely cover that as well. I just think you need, in the back of your mind, that sort of quality of build if you're going to be doing that sort of thing.
Yeah okay, cool, sweet.
There you go.
Joe
Branton.
I was really trying to decide whether or not I should throw any in because of course mine are bass related and there are lots less bass players who listen to this podcast than guitarists, but I'll throw in one this time round, and then we'll see sort of what time we've got when we go back round between you two. But I mean, it would be ridiculous if I didn't mention Billy Sheehan on an artist bass podcast, so I kind of have to. And of course Billy Sheehan does have a really unique setup, like you know, I wrote down sort of three people for this, but out of the three, this is he. Billy Sheehan definitely has the most unique setup:
a bass, a lead, and an amp.
Exactly, he has all three of those, but I mean, to be honest, Billy Sheehan is, because he does so many clinics and so many, he's so involved in endorsements.
Yeah,
you know, there are you know, tons of videos of him explaining his setup all over the internet. So, you know, I'll be relatively brief with it. But Billy Sheehan, of course, plays the Yamaha, his own signature model, the Yamaha Attitude. Now on the Attitude 3, I think, or Attitude 4, yeah. I forget now.
Really good looking basses.
Really cool basses. The Attitude was a model, it was kind of Yamaha's take on the precision bass. It was brought out alongside the Pacifica guitars in the 80s.
It has a headstock that resembles that sort of thing, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. Headstock. Yeah, it's exactly that sort of thing. They only ever did it as kind of an entry level instrument, really, when it came out. It was quite a cheap build. And when Billy Sheehan came over to Yamaha, he started off playing BB basses, because he originally and sort of quite famously had his precision bass, which he only had one. And he was such a ridiculous player and such a heavy player that he destroyed it. There are some videos you can watch of him showing his old P bass and the condition it was in. Bear in mind, they were a globally touring band at the time he got picked up by Yamaha. He was still playing that this one unfinished precision bass with a taut guard that had worn through, and he'd tried loads of different pickup configurations in it. Yeah, so there were holes in it all over the place, because he'd fitted in an old Gibson EBO pickup, but of course the string spacing on EBOs is totally different to on Fenders, so it didn't really line up very well.
Yeah,
he'd tried putting a bridge pickup in and then given up on that, so there's a hole in the bridge sort of where that was. And and essentially, because of all the he would use, of course, because there's no whammy bar on a bass, he would push the neck he'd done that so much that he shows in a video how the neck pocket is filled with plectrums, where he's just put loads of plectrums in the hole.
He's slowly pulling the screws out of the body.
Yeah, and it's so wrecked that he just fills it with plectrums to try and keep the bass in one piece. And he never had it professionally looked at to get that sorted out.
Of course, I mean, when you've got picks to hand, why would you
get
it fixed? At that point, he was a professional, like, globally touring band, Matty Man as well. At that point, you'd just be like, I need to get someone to look at this, and they will do it for free.
If you've only got one bass, you can't spare it.
Very true.
You can't give it to someone, because you can't gig.
To be fair, he had, he could have just sorted something else out, but he had such a specific setup that there wasn't like a bass that he could buy.
Yeah.
He'd have to make a whole new one. But he went to Yamaha and he played BBs for a while when he first started those out. And to be honest, he did exactly the same thing to those. They were just giving him kind of high-end stock BBs, and he was scalloping the frets himself and like cutting out big holes and fitting extra pickups in and stuff like that. And
I think that was what people did in the 80s.
I think so, yeah.
It was wicked.
They were trying to try new things. They were really experimenting, whereas now we kind of have everything.
Yeah.
So there's very little to experiment with. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It was just a time when people were trying out new things. But anyway, he since then went back to kind of the precision-based style and had his Yamaha Attitude made. And he's still as fussy as he was when he was changing out all the pickups and everything when he got the Attitude. So the Attitude is a precision-based style pickup, so it has his signature DiMarzio Willpower P pickup in the middle, and then in the neck it has his signature, again, it's just the Billy Sheehan Willpower EBO style
flat pickup.
Yeah, humbucking pickup, just going right in the neck, kind of like a Tele bass or a Gibson EBO. The neck size that he had fitted to this bass was the biggest neck that Yamaha would make for him. The biggest neck that they said it was possible for them to make. And he says that if they could have made it a little bit bigger, he would have been happier.
As in
chunky, deep, really profile. Deep. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Is that still the same neck that you can buy now?
It's still on. The Attitude's ridiculous. It's considering he's a shred style player, such an odd neck choice. It's like worse than a 51 style P bass, which is a big sort of baseball bat neck.
That, and you've played neck this is huge. Bass
on an Attitude, yeah. Yeah, it's just huge. It's just massive. It feels like a big old P bass, which is bonkers. I mean, if you think of the spec of it, massive neck, humbucker in the neck position, and this is being played by like a shredder. I'd expect like a jazz bass neck and like bridge pickups. You know, like single coils right on the bridge to pick up all those high things. The sort of, Pino Palladino style.
A Mr. Big thing.
Yeah.
Because Paul Gilbert has like a shred style Ibanez with like the biggest Ibanez neck going.
We checked it out when we were in Birmingham.
He never used to play skinny necks. He wanted bigger necks, but they'd never really put them on. Yeah. I think.
Like that PM. G808. I can't even remember what
his Paul ridiculous Gilbert. RG with the fake F holes.
Yeah, the neck. It's a 22 fret guitar with a huge neck on it.
Yeah,
and it's an RG model.
Fantastic.
But the dude, like, and I could as well. I find bigger necks easier to play super fast alternate picking on. You know, than like a slim Ibanez neck to the huge Ibanez neck.
Yeah, you know? I guess it is. It is so much a preference thing. I don't think there is one that's an advantage over the other. Of course,
definitely.
Luke, you for the longest time were playing all the Wizard necks, the ridiculous.
I've spent so long playing my Strat now, I can't get on with them again.
Yeah,
I find them just too wide and too sort of flat.
Mm. Yeah,
but yeah.
What radius is on your Strat at the moment?
It's an American standard, so
9.5.
It's up to maybe a 12.
Yeah.
Like, it's just it's
nice.
Yeah, it just works.
It so much becomes just like what you're used to after a while.
Yeah.
I did 2 weeks touring where I just took two jazz basses, and then when I got back, I had my P bass came back from the shop where it's been refinished, and it took me ages to kind of get back used to such a difference in profile between a P and a J. Yeah. I think it's just what you're used to, isn't it?
It is hard work.
It is.
Unless you get used to playing lots of different things, and then you have the versatility to be able to use things for different stuff. Yeah. Like, some players quite happily switch between anything.
Yeah, like anything. Yeah.
Like, I mean, John Mayer played Strats for ages, and then all of a sudden he was playing a couple of Gibsons. Now he's doing that Charvel.
Charvel?
Yeah, he's playing some, like, old 80s Charvel thing.
Really?
I think.
Oh, interesting.
Didn't know that.
What was the guitar he played at the Grammys?
I have no idea.
I don't know. He's played Duesenbergs as well for a little bit.
Yeah, so, I mean, some people just skip between things.
Versatile people.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's kind of Billy Sheehan's guitar. I mean, the Attitude I find really interesting because they've Yamaha have even developed this way of artificially aging the wood.
Yeah, I really like that.
Have you read about this? Yeah. It's, I can't remember the name of the treatment now, but it's an amazing idea.
ARE,
that's it. Yeah, so it's that they essentially take the bodies to they do it only with their pianos, but they do it with Billy Sheehan Attitude.
The L series acoustics now.
Oh, really? The acoustics.
Yeah,
well,
they've started spilling out to some stuff.
That's really cool. So what they do is they take the body wood. Well, in the case of the Billy Sheehan, they take the separated body wood before it's been finished or anything like that, and they put it in what looks like a time machine, some sort of weird capsule chamber, and essentially it has heat, pressure.
And vibration. And,
yeah, I think vibration and moisture, I think, as well, applied to it. And that that artificially makes the sap crystallize, which is what happens to the sap present in your guitar bodies over, say, a 20, 30-year period of time, which is basically Yamaha did a load of research into why do old guitars sound better? Like, why do people even think that when we have... It's easier for us to reach higher build standards these days. We have things that are made to mathematical precision. Why on earth would these things that were made by sort of 20 blokes in some factory in California in the 50s, why would that be better? And this is what they came up with, that it's the way wood ages and the way sap ages in the wood. So so on the Billy Sheehan, they've kind of sought to replicate that. They also introduced a couple of extra... holes a couple of extra holes the neck pocket, what do you call the things,
screws?
The neck screws, they introduced a couple of
those.
I was going,
being sarcastic.
I know
so going, they have how many go, do you think
well there's four, but then there's two going diagonally up into the bottom of the neck as well to secure it really tight into the pocket, which I thought was just a really nice little touch. I mean, obviously very time consuming, which is why it's a £2,000 bass guitar, but still really, really cool. I haven't talked about his amps at all, but I'm aware that I've gone on ages about his attitude. So
I'm going to talk about Billy Sheehan and keep it short.
Yeah, so that's what I said.
I don't think that's possible.
Haven't got onto his pedals or his amps, so I'm going to move on round to Luke.
Cool.
I think we'll probably only get one more each in here.
Cool.
So I'll go for the quickest of the two, and then maybe we'll come back to next week.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Next week, at the start of the week, we'll do our last two from each of you.
Sounds cool.
Well, my next one was just going to be the two guitarists from Fugazi.
What an interesting choice, and what a massively different choice from Nino as well.
Mostly, the other choice has a massive pedal board and a huge rig. I was sort of thinking other players that inspire me as a player without using that so much and without relying on the gear, but it still being so integral to their tone and to them as players. It's Fugazi. There's Guy Picasso and Ian Mackay have played. I think Guy plays the Rickies. He plays a couple of Rickenbacker 330s, and Guy plays. Ian plays a couple of Gibson SGs. Pretty stock standard things, both going into a pair of JCM 800s, not really any pedals. I think one of them uses a boost, and they set their amps up slightly differently, and they haven't done anything differently for 20 something years.
That's bonkers. That's unexpected. You expect every few years a band to change something about their setup, to try something new.
They are just totally about making the music and not about the gear aspect of it. A little bit like, I mean, people expect someone like Tom Morello to have maybe played around with things just because he's so known for creating crazy tones. But he's had the same pedal board and the same amp and the same settings on the same amp since they recorded the first Rage Against the Machine album.
That's bonkers. He has had a few guitars, but...
Yeah, he's had a few. I mean, he's always...
All sort of cheap rubbish ones. There, yeah.
But yeah, I think that they just make such a statement about this is about what we play and not about what we play it with, and I think that is quite an interesting thing musically.
Yeah, I guess so,
for me at least.
Okay, cool. And Rickenbacker 330s,
yeah,
still quite a high-end guitar.
It's quite high-end. I mean, it's not what you'd expect from what is a reasonably heavy band.
Yeah,
given that, I mean, you can't get anything heavy out of a 330.
Which one is the 330? I'm not very good with my Ricky numbers.
330s are the flat ones with no contouring. Still got the sort of double cutaway shape.
Right, but so the flat weird body. Sort of almost triangles cut out of what would otherwise be an acoustic shape. So
Yeah, that one. Still got sort of lacquered fingerboard and things. It is still very much a Rickenbacker. Still got the funny bridge that gets in the way when you play it. A very quirky guitar. Very much the kind of guitar that people that play Rickenbackers play.
Right.
And don't tend to play anything else.
Yeah.
And yeah, as I say, SG and a boost pedal,
JCM 800s. That seems to be a flavour of Guitar Heroes of yours.
It seems to be a flavour of chat today, I think.
JCM 800s were just the thing, weren't they, for so long. I write them off instantly and don't care about them or the sounds they make.
Really?
Just because they're so...
ubiquitous.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they are everywhere. I mean, you get a good one and you set it up right, they sound incredible.
That's true. I'm sure that is the case. It was just, I think of them as coming from a time when no one had any choice, and that's why people played them. And now people have choice and no one plays them anymore. The only people who played them are the people who played them back then.
I think that's a fairly astute point. I mean, back then, but then people used to play them and mod them.
Yeah.
And it was because they were around.
That's true, yeah.
And sort of by the time that Fugazi was sort of coming out and starting to make records, the 800 was quite a cheap thing and you could just pick them up for very little. So I mean, maybe that's why they played them, and it was just,
I guess, they were the amplifier of American punk rock essentially through the 90s,
just music and punk rock in general. I think,
I guess so, they were kind of the loudest thing you could get, and as you say, really cheap and easy to pick up.
Yeah, just everywhere.
Yeah,
but yeah, so that's, I think that's the rig.
Cool, sweet.
Done in its entirety.
Joss Allen.
Yeah.
Hit me up.
I'm going to go with the most inspirational player out of the two that I have left. I'm going to go with a guy called M.L. Wurstler.
I have no idea who that is.
Is that one
most
name,
people
or?
Don't know who M.L. Wurstler is. It's Emil Wurstler. Emil Wurstler used to play in a band called Darth.
Okay.
You know Darth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Another heavy band that I really, really like. Darth aren't really doing that much anymore. So ML Wurstler moved to playing bass for Chimera. Right. Instead of guitar, and then they got a bass player and he moved over to playing guitar for Chimera, and now he's just a PRS demonstrator. So cool. He just plays, like, you know, NAMM shows and all London guitar shows, all those different shows as a PRS demonstrator. So hence being a PRS demonstrator, the guitar he plays is PRS. He has a PRS Modern Eagle in a custom finish, custom 22 Modern Eagle custom finish that he had done in a blood red finish, which is really cool. Goes from black to sort of a blood red. He now plays PRS amps. Really surprising about him. He used to play in Darth and Chimera and all these heavy bands, but he's a super, super jazz player. Like, right. Incredible jazz player. And PRS have given him a couple of private stock archtops.
Okay.
Like, you know, they're like, I don't know what the models are. You know, the big-bodied PRS guitars with, like, the big speed.
I didn't know they did them.
Yes.
They did big-body guitars as well.
I'm not that familiar with them.
They're slim. They're quite thin, but they're like, semi-hollow style. So they're, like, jazzers, but slimmer guitars.
Oh, bonkers.
One he has got a Bigsby, and the other one is a hardtail. And, yeah, just an unbelievably cool player. And the amp that he used to use... was a Mesoboogie single rectifier on the vintage selection, you know, not the modern, the vintage section, but with like a tube screamer in front of it. Get that super tight, good Mesoboogie sound, because I always feel as if I had a single rectifier and on the modern sound, it was too fizzy on the top end.
Unless you get them really, really loud.
Yeah.
There's
so
much power there. You've really got to push them.
Exactly. So I always found it fizzy on the top end. So I used to put it on the modern section, but then there wasn't enough drive there for me. So
the vintage section.
Yeah, the vintage section. So you stick a tube screamer in front of it, and then you're laughing, really, because it pushes it, you know, enough for lead work or rhythm work and stuff like that.
There are some great alternatives to a single rectifier today in the Mesoboogie kind of catalogue.
Oh, definitely. I mean, most of their amplification now you can get, like, at a low wattage model, without it sounding, you know, as because of it being a low wattage model, they sound fat and
what was the
Mark 525?
Yeah, the Mark 525,
which is cool.
All of that.
Well, exactly. We and you know, we still can't stop selling them. They've got to be coming up for one of the most popular Mesoboogie amplifiers, you know, that they've
They even do a mini rectifier. They do the mini rec.
Yeah, of course, the mini rec, which is a little bit different because it has that weird sort of
lunchbox
chassis. Lunchbox amps, I'm not sure if they're doing as well as they used to do. I think people are getting more into
Tiny Terrors are still selling really
Because the Lunchbox range was like an affordable thing, wasn't it?
It was a way to buy an affordable valve amp,
but now people at like Mesoboogie and Hughes and Kettner are doing it, and you're looking at 600 and up, you know what I mean? The Mesoboogie ones are £1,000.
Yeah, exactly. It's a much more serious thing now than I think it was.
We had the guy from Moog come in and do some demonstrations, and he bought all his own gear, and he bought a Mark 525 and the little two by 12 cabinets, you know, 112, 112, both of the separate cabinets.
Oh, amazing.
He had
a great pedal board set up
Pedal board set up. He had
so obviously he had the Moog pedals, which was what he was there to demonstrate, but he brought with him
H9 pedal board as well. He had two H9s and then all the bits and pieces that he would use with the H9.
Which were things like it was all really high quality. I thought we just had a Crowther Hotcake on there, an Ibanez
Maxon.
TS9. Oh, no, it was a Maxon,
it was
wasn't
a Maxon
it?
One,
which,
yeah.
Which, yeah, loads of time for the Maxon version of the TS3. They are totally cool.
It's really cool stuff.
Well, Maxon built them originally.
Yeah.
That's why I find it a bit strange that, I mean, people go to the Ibanez TS9 or the 808 because of the name, I think. It might sound a little bit different.
And Mini,
of course, as well. But I've always used a Maxon. I mean, I've always used, but because you can get like the Maxon, you can get like the 808 and the TS9 version of the Maxons, and they're like, they come in at like £80.
Yeah,
£89, something like that.
They're
where the tube screamers are about £130.
Yeah, Ibanez have really secured themselves as the tube screamer company to
definitely,
get, whereas Maxon are still making cheaper ones that are still absolutely brilliant. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, I will. We'll call it there, and we'll hold off our next hero guitarist for the start of next week's podcast.
Cool.
We're actually right up on time, so I'm not even going to do any questions this week. We'll call it a day at this, and then yeah, next week we'll come back to those hero things, and we'll have a brand new topic, and we'll hopefully get around to answering some questions. So,
sweet.
So, and make sure you ask questions. You can find us, of course, on the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/guitar nerds group, or you can tweet us at gak_co_uk, or feel free to email us at podcast@gak.co.uk. you can find me on Twitter at yosef_900. Luke Taft, how can people get hold of you?
Luke.taft@gak.co.uk.
and Joss Allen,
You can get me on Instagram if you just search for Joss Allen. You can obviously ask me questions on the YouTube channel under the comment sections below, or email me on joss.allen@gak.co.uk.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'll see you next week, people.
Cheers.
Bye.